ஓம் சகனாபவது, சகனௌ புனக்து, சக வீரியம் கரவாவகை, தேஜஸ்வினாவதீதமஸ்து மா விதுஷாவகை. ஓம் சாந்தி சாந்தி சாந்தி. ஹரிஹி ஓம். Let there be peace, harmony and joy everywhere. Om peace, peace, peace. So our topic, as you know, the topic is Journey to Infinite Life. Now, there is a real description of a journey in this Upanishad. It is a well-known, it is one of the most well-known sections of the entire Vedic literature, the journey to immortality. Normally, we have two types of journeys in our life. One journey, the normal life, pursuit of happiness, prosperity, success, happiness in this life, and also maybe pursuit of happiness, enjoyment in heaven. Now, I have to explain something very important here, and that is a very important point for Western audience. When we use the word heaven in the Vedantic literature or Indian philosophy, the concept of heaven the meaning of the concept of heaven in Vedantic literature is totally different from what it means in the Abrahamic tradition. So that is a very important point to remember. See, in Abrahamic tradition, kingdom of heaven, you go to heaven, heaven has got a spiritual aspect about it. Heaven implies close proximity, living with God, living in the world of God, coexisting with angels, you are in the company of angels, divine beings. You go to heaven as a result of blessings, a grace of God, or grace of angels. That's what we mean by the word heaven in the traditional Abrahamic tradition. So you find the city of God, Augustine, city of God. It gives a classic description of those who are with heavenly minded, what you call a sattvic type, those who have got a divine aspect about them. So there is a spiritual element in the concept of heaven in Abrahamic tradition. But in Vedanta, it is different. In Vedantic tradition, heaven is not a big deal. It is not something that a highly evolved person will aspire for, unlike what it is in Christian tradition. So in Christian tradition, you talk about some heavenly subjects, means God, grace, and emancipation, and things like that. But here, heaven is like staying in a 5-star hotel for a long time without making any payment. It is a result of some good actions you have done in this life, some meritorious deeds, mostly Vedic rituals, as a result of which you accrue some result. You earn the right to live in heaven, long life, healthy body, plenty of wonderful things to enjoy. This is the concept of heaven in Indian philosophy in general. There is a school of philosophy called Purva Mimamsa, which tells you that this is the only goal of human existence, and which is condemned and refuted by Shankaracharya and other great Vedantic scholars, who say this kind of heaven is not the highest destination for human beings. So that's a very important point to remember. I think perhaps I should have mentioned this morning itself. Surga is the word used, which means heaven, you do a lot of good deeds with a definite motive, and purpose, as a result of which you acquire a lot of merits which guarantee long life in heaven. And you'll be born again in this world as ordinary human beings. Reaching heaven doesn't mean any kind of spiritual attainment in the Indian philosophical tradition. That's a very important point, remember. Now, coming to this subject, there are two types of journeys normally. The one journey, a pursuit of happiness, enjoyment, prosperity, wealth, of course, following some principles of dharma, rules and regulations. That is called pravritti, the path of action. It's called abhyudaya, going in pursuit of artha and kama, enjoyments and the means for enjoyments without deviating from the path of dharma. So this is called pravritti or abhyudaya, or it is preya in the language of Kathopanishad. It's called avidya. Avidya doesn't mean ignorance. Avidya actually here means looking upon this as the highest pursuit of human existence. That is called avidya here. I mean ignorance of the higher spiritual values in that sense. This is one kind of human journey. It is not immortality. It is that journey is to death, to be born again. Depending upon what you have done in this life, you carry with you baggage of samskaras, vasanas, and vrittis. And you, with that, you are born again. You continue your journey. There is not much spiritual progress. That there is another journey, and that's what we are going to discuss now. That journey is a journey to immortality, which is what Yama is going to focus on. And that is related to vidya, nivritti, sreya, nisreya, and so on. It is related to the highest spiritual enlightenment, spiritual wisdom. It is called nivritti, means renunciation of obsession or obsessive attachment to enjoyments and worldly pleasures. Taking to a life of spiritual sadhana, spirituality. Pursuing the path of immortality. That is the other journey. The second journey is explained in the language of a great imagery in the Kathopanishad. That's what we are going to discuss now. The verse comes in the third section. Atmanam radhinam vidhi, shariram radhameyavacha, buddhintu sarade vidhi, manapragrahameyavacha, indriyani paranyahu, vishayan steshu gojaran, atmendriya mano yuktam bhokte tyahur manishinaha. This is the two verses that describe the imagery of a journey on a chariot. Now, what is this? What this means? You are undertaking a journey on a chariot. So Yama, the teacher, he views human personality consisting of body, senses, mind, intellect, and so on, in the light of this evolutionary movement in search of the highest spiritual truth. Now, what are the characters here? First, there should be horses and there should be a chariot. Now, horses are sense organs. Sense organ means karmendriya and jnanendriya both. That means karmendriyas are indriyas, senses, sense objects with which we work, we grasp with our hand, we walk with our feet, and so on. And jnanendriyas are the senses of perception. Karmendriyas are senses of action. Jnanendriyas are senses of perception. These 10 indriyas, 10 senses, these constitute the horses. So eyes with which you see, ears with which you hear, nostrils with which you smell, tongue with which you speak, and of course skin with which you touch things. So all these senses constitute senses of perception and senses of action like hands, feet and so on. Now the point is, the focus is, the senses should be under the control of the charioteer. The charioteer should not be under the control of the senses. Frequently, the person who undertakes the other journey is controlled by the horses. Because his instrument for controlling the horses may not be steady in his hands, and he also may be wavering. So you can imagine this journey. We'll discuss this. It's a very famous. In fact, this describes the whole Jainism, the whole theme that we are going to discuss. A journey on a chariot. Chariot is the human body. In this human body, there could be two types of travelers. I mean, those who is actually planning to travel somewhere, from some place to somewhere in this horse. He is the owner of the horse. It could be the journey of a person who may not have a steady charioteer. Charioteer is intellect. And the charioteer may be drunk. In that case, you know, the reins won't be steady in his hands. The horses may not be under his control. The horses may take him in the opposite direction. He may fall over a precipice. So the traveler should, first of all, choose an intelligent charioteer, driver, intellect. And he should be steady. And then the charioteer, the driver, controls the horses with reins in mind. Mind is the instrument with which the intellect controls the senses. Frequently, senses can control mind and intellect and the charioteer also. That's what frequently happens. So, in the Gita, there is a verse, Dhyayato Vishayan Pumsaha Sangasteshu Ubajayade Sangha Sanjayade Kama Kama Krodho Vijayade Krodhar Bhavadi Sammoha Sammoha Smriti Vibhrama Smriti Bhramsha Buddhi Nasho Buddhi Nasha Pranashiri. It's a very wonderful description of somebody going abnormal, actually. Buddhi Nasha means the degeneration of the mind. So when we focus intensely all the time on sense objects, then what happens? Not because we are interested, but also because that's the only thing available, that's the only thing with which you connect, so we become attached to it. So that's a very important point to remember. We may get attached, trapped to something, not only because we are too much interested in it, but also that's the only thing available in front of us, as what is happening, you know, in technology, it's very often media presenting only unpleasant, undesirable news items. So without anything meritorious, anything that is desirable. So mind gets attached to that. Not because mind is necessarily interested, that could be one reason, of course, but because that's the only thing available around you, so you get trapped. This happens about the children and student community especially. And as a result of it, you know, people develop a desire for those things. They aspire for them. They don't always succeed. When they don't succeed, they become angry. They become discontented. Then they lose their sense of balance and they degenerate. Buddhinasa pranasyati. So this is a description in the Bhagavad Gita, second chapter, Siddha Prajna Lakshana, a famous verse. Now, this is what happens when the horses control the chariot and the charioteer. When the driver of the chariot is not able to control the horses with the reins. So the reins, like the mind. Your mind should be steady. So your mind is steady, then mind can dictate terms to the senses. And then the senses can be diverted towards healthy channels. One important point is, if you do not give proper diversion to the senses will go after their own goals. The senses can, the horses can make the journey their journey instead of the charioteer's journey or the journey of the person who is traveling in it. In that case, one may not reach the destination or reach the opposite destination. So the one important point is that the senses should be completely under the control of these reins. And reins should be steadily controlled by the charioteer. The reins of mind. So that means the whole journey, whether it's going to succeed or not, depends upon the ability of the charioteer to control the horses with his reins. So that's an important point. Now, how to control the horses? And you know, the horses have to follow a path, a road. That is a road, the path, the road of sense objects. Sense objects are brought to the mind by the senses. So eyes bring visuals and ears bring audio impressions. So also all the five senses of perception can bring their own respective impressions to the mind. So mind could get polluted eating dirty food all the time, because what the senses bring is compared to food by one of the great commentator Shankaracharya, according to Shankaracharya, senses are like food. So when you see an undesirable object, you see the object not only when your eyes are open, you see the object also when your eyes are closed, in the form of impressions or memories or dreams. So these are all the same. According to Vedanta, memories, impressions and dreams belong to the same level. So when you see an elephant with open eyes, and then when you close, you continue seeing the elephant with closed eyes in the form of memory or impression. So one can see without the eyes opened. One can hear without ears, because you listen to a music yesterday and tomorrow you repeat it, because mentally you are hearing it again, so you repeat it. So also all the five senses bring food. Food is aharati, ahara means something that goes in, that's food. And that influences your culture. What we eat not only influences our body, but also influences the culture, the mind, the intellect, thoughts, emotions, all can be influenced by what we eat. So whatever the senses bring can either pollute the mind or can strengthen the mind. But then how does the mind control the horses? Mind itself cannot control the senses. The reins cannot themselves control the horses. The reins should be steadily held by a charioteer, the intellect. So the intellect should be steady. Then the reins will be steady in the driver's hands, the charioteer's hands. And then you know what happens? The horses will listen to the dictates of the reins and thereby obey the dictates of the intellect. So then another point, the intellect also may not be always steady. If you analyze these different parts of the human system, for example, our our senses, as we know, they always change. They always move, they're wavering. Mind not always steady. Intellect may not be always steady. You are attracted towards an idea, you decide to do something now, and you change that decision. That's a nishyatmika antakarnavritti is buddhi, that is intellect. And sankalpa vikalpatmika antakarnavritti is mind. So two types of thoughts or emotions. Do this or not to do this, like Hamlet. Two conflicting ideas coming together. That is what is called mind, sankalpa and vikalpa. One thought and its contrary thought. Conflicts. It will vikshipta the mind. Yoga psychology. And then intellect is called nishyatmika antakarnavritti. Its duty is to decide. But intellect cannot always decide. We may take one decision today, we may take another decision tomorrow. So compared to the senses, mind is more steady normally. Compared to the intellect, compared to the mind, intellect is more steady. But intellect also cannot be always steady. The intellect, the driver, should listen to the demands of the traveler who decide where he should go. Otherwise, the traveler won't be able to reach his destination. Who is the traveler? The traveler is bhoktetyahur manishinaha. Bhokta means jivatma. Body, mind, intellect complex in which Atman resides. That is bhokta, jivatma, the individual soul, what you call soul in the Western psychology and philosophy, individual soul. So, within us, there is this Atman, but this Atman, it is embodied. It functions in the company of body, mind, intellect, different samskaras, vasanas and vrittis and so on. So the Atma, Jivatma should decide where it should go. And then the driver listens. Then driver controls the horses with the reins in his hands. So when the intellect is linked to Atman, it becomes steady. The intellect becomes steady. When the mind is linked to intellect, then mind also becomes steady. When the horses are strongly controlled by the reins, then horses also become steady. So, one should always have a definite spiritual goal in mind. And that spiritual goal should be to realize one's own inner divinity within, which is what we are going to describe in the coming pages. Why it is important? So the coming verses also explain. Yastu avijnanavan bhavadi ayuktena manasa sada tasi indriyani avasyani dushtasu aiva sarathehi. So suppose the charioteer, the driver, is not able to control his own mind and through his mind control the senses. Then what happens? Horses which are totally out of control will normally take you to the wrong destination. So also we will be taken along the wrong road and wrong destination. Yastu vijnanavan bhavati yuktena manasasada tasa indriyani vasyani sadasyaiva sarathehi. Indriyani vasyani means within control. If the senses are within the control of the mind, and if the mind is like reins, and to control the intellect, and the intellect is linked to Atman, then the horses also become steady, reach the goal. This is the essence of this imagery. Now we are going to discuss the spiritual implications of this. Why is it necessary to control the horses? We already explained some part of it. The point is, each of the 10 senses can cause our spiritual death. That's an important point, remember. Each of these 10 senses, you walk the wrong road, you do the wrong thing, you see the wrong object, hear the wrong word, all these can cause spiritual death, which means each of these can bring wrong impressions into the mental system. And these impressions will remain accumulated in the mental system. And they later on decide how we live, what we do with our mind and senses. That's why there is a famous verse in one of the Sanskrit texts which describes this particular aspect, the importance of controlling the senses and keeping the senses under the control of the mind, and how the mind should be linked to the intellect, and why it is important that intellect should not be left on itself, it should be linked to Atman. So Atman is like a pillar, iron pillar, or an anchor to which all this should be tied. Then they remain steady. Shabdadibi panjabireva panja panjatma pusa gunena baddhaha guranga madanga padanga meenaha bhringa nara panjabiranchidakim. It comes in one of the verses in Viveka Chudamani's Prakarana Grantha, one of the foundational texts of Vedanta. It also is an imagery. How animals get killed, or members, different members of the animal kingdom. So it gives some examples from the animal kingdom. First, it takes the example of deer, kuranga. Deer, it hides in a bush, and when the hunter comes, he cannot see the deer. He sings some music or plays on an instrument. Listening to this noise, the deer comes out of the bush. At that time, the hunter releases the arrow and the deer is killed. So just one sense of hearing the ears, or the sense of hearing, causes the death of the deer. Then elephant is mentioned, kuranga madangami elephant. Elephants move in large numbers, in herds, touching each other. So they feel the presence of all the elephant members of the elephant family by touching. Small baby elephants will be guided by parents, their parents, and so on. So what happens is, normally they are trapped in pits. They fall in a pit and they are trapped. That's what happens. So because they touch each other, they lose their direction and they fall in a pit and they are killed or enslaved. Then padanga means the moths and creatures which emerge when you start a blazing fire in during winter rainy season. They come in thousands, these moths, small little flies. They are attracted by the brilliant color of the flame. So the eyes, the sense of sight becomes a trap for them, and they are killed. Then fish, they are caught, trapped by the sense of taste. And then there are some other small little creatures which fly from flowers to flowers in gardens, and they are also killed by other small little animals because they are trapped by the sense of smell. So each of these senses can be a trapdoor for them. To death, they are killed. Now Shankaracharya concludes the verse, Narapanjibi Ranjidakim. What he says, in the context of human beings, all these five senses simultaneously are hyperactive. Mind is being driven to all these sense objects. You can, if you read from a Vedantic perspective, if you read the newspaper headlines, how people get attracted or misguided by seeing wrong things in the electronic media or social media, you can imagine what dangerous results can come if our senses are not properly under control. But senses can be controlled only by steady mind. Mind cannot control itself. Mind should be controlled by a proper ideal, a concept, a guiding motto. We should have some higher ideal in life, which is what is called intellect, which is what makes intellect steady. And this ideal should be linked to some spiritual principle, something universal, something related to universal peace or happiness or something. Then what happens? Our journey becomes fruitful. This is one important imagery in this Upanishad. Now, another important point is, in the same Upanishad, there is a beautiful description of this Atman, which I already mentioned this morning, but we'll describe much more elaborately in the coming verses. Okay. So I'm going to take one very important verse, and that is a description of what is Atma is. That's a very famous verse. I already referred to this earlier. Anuraniyan makato mahiyan atma sijintoho nikhitam guhayam tamakradu pasyadi vitashokaha dhadu prasadat mahimanam atmanaha. This is the description of the absolute reality as an immanent divine principle present in all of us. The next verse also describes, Asino duram vrajadi shayano yadi sarvataka kastum madamadam devam madanyo jnadu markadi. These are two important verses. The first verse tells us this. This Atman, it is present as the immanent divine spark, divine principle in all of us. It is also present in an amoeba and also a Buddha. There's a famous quotation from Vivekananda in this context. It's a very famous quotation. The difference between an amoeba and a Buddha is not one of kind, is one of degrees, but not of kind. One may be puzzled on the face of it. The difference between an amoeba and a Buddha. Buddha could be a generic term for any spiritually enlightened person. Buddha in Sanskrit means the enlightened one. So what's the difference between an amoeba and a Buddha? It is one of degrees. In Buddha, the presence of this Atman is manifest in his full effulgence. In amoeba, it is barely present, that's all. So, what's the difference between different people, say 8 billion people inhabiting this planet Earth? 8 billion reflective media, mediums you may call if you want. See, 8 billion mirrors in which this Atman is present, Atman is reflected. Now, the reflection varies, but what is reflected, the real thing, doesn't change. And the quality of the reflection varies depending upon the cleanliness or the purity of the glass. If there is dust and filth on the glass, the reflection won't be very clear. If it is clear, if the mirror is clean, then the reflection will be clean. So in a Buddha, in an enlightened version, this Atman is in full effulgence. But in amoeba, it's like reflection of Atman in a mirror which is full of dust. So a fraction could be seen. That's what Vivekananda meant. Which means, spiritually the whole creation is one because it is present in the smallest of the small, anohu aniyan and mahataha mahiyan. It is present as the immanent indweller in the smallest and also in the largest. Now, where is it present? Hridayam, nihidam guhayam. It is present as the essence within our hearts. Now, those who are leading a pure life, those who have no selfish desire, those who practice unselfishness, those whose mind is pure, free from all impurities, impure thoughts, impure impressions, vibrations, samskaras, their mind becomes the right receptacle, medium for the manifestation of this divine reality within us. So that is the most important, one of the most important verses in this Upanishad, which explains Atman as the immanent reality in all of us, the universalism. Another point that the Upanishad mentions elsewhere, which we don't have time to expound, is that the realization of this immanent divine reality is possible in this life itself. For that, we do not have to wait for next life. So in Vedanta, there is one important concept that is called Jivan Mukti, which means liberation even when you are living in this world. There are Krama Mukti, Videha Mukti, many other, which, there are some philosophers according to whom liberation is possible only at the time of the liquidation of the body, at the time of death. And there are others who tell you for different levels of spiritual seekers, that liberation is Krama Mukti, slow by, through gradual process, gradual evolution. Anyway, but the unique contribution of Shankaracharya is that it is possible for one to attain the highest spiritual liberation even when you are living in this world. And not only that, and you'd be happy to hear this from me, even when you are engaged in all your ordinary day-to-day secular activities. This may be a bit of a puzzle for us. To give an example, to dive on this idea, I can give the story from Mahabharata. It's called Vyadha Gita. It is as beautiful, as grand a poetical section of the Mahabharata, which has got 145 verses, larger version, as the Bhagavad Gita itself. In the Mahabharata, there is a dialogue between a saint or somebody who went away from his home to become a saint and a great spiritual teacher. And this spiritual teacher was, by profession, a butcher, selling fish, cutting meat, selling fish in a market. And he's a mighty big Vedantin, giving the highest spiritual truths to somebody who went to become an ascetic. It doesn't mean that every butcher is a saint or a philosopher. It's not means. But the idea is this. This butcher, he left his home when he was small, spent decades in a forest, practiced meditation, then became a great saint. But then it didn't mean that he won't know, I'm a saint, I won't do any of my work. He didn't do that. He continued doing the work, which was the only work which he knew, because his father taught him that work. Maybe in those days, many of these jobs were transmitted generation to generation. India did not have this high dignity of labor. Mostly there were trade guilds. So the jobs were transmitted from generation to generation in India. But the story is something great about it. There was a great ascetic who practiced meditation under a tree for a very long time. And then one day he was highly disturbed because two birds were fighting on a branch above where we are sitting, and he was disturbed and he got angry. He should not have got angry because that was not the purpose of his leaving his parents, leaving his home to become an ascetic. But we had acquired some spiritual powers anyway. So he was how much enamored of that. And so he looked at the birds with great anger, and the birds burned to ashes, as the story goes. He congratulated himself, got up from the seat, went about looking for alms. You know, this like the Franciscan friars in the Middle Ages, alms for St. Francis, like that, you know, in ancient times, in 4,000, 5,000 millennium BC, in India, this practice. Any ascetic or a pilgrim or somebody is going to some holy Himalayan pilgrim centers or going to learn Vedas from one part of the country to another part will go to householders' houses and will proclaim Bhavadi Bhiksham Deki, give us alms. That's what it means, like alms for St. Francis, equivalent of that, Vedanti equivalent, so to speak. So he went to a house and shouted, please give me alms. And he may have done it 2-3 times. He became somewhat impatient, and then he heard a noise coming from inside the home, maybe from the kitchen, a lady's voice, a woman's voice, please wait a minute. And then he waited, but he became impatient when the lady came out with alms. If you want an example in Christian tradition, you find this in the way of a pilgrim. The pilgrim walks about all over Russia, and he travels, and on his way to Jeddah, he visits the homes of Russian Orthodox Christians, and housewives and mothers come out with alms, greeting him. That practice was common. I think the only country outside India where it was a common practice, before, except Buddhist countries, of course, was in Russia, because the influence of the Russian Orthodox Church, the concept of pilgrimage. So anyway, so this man became impatient. So he shouted, how dare you ask me to wait for a minute? And when he didn't say anything, but this thought just flashed his mind. At that moment, the lady responded, please don't get angry. There are no birds here for you to burn to ashes. Now, he had walked several miles to reach that home. He didn't know how this lady came to know of this incident. Then he became humble. That's the greatness of the man. Because he had practiced meditation and prayer for a long time, he had a spiritual sensitivity to understand his mistake. And he repented. And he asked her, who is your teacher? I'm sorry, I got angry. Who is your teacher? So that's the difference between those who do some spiritual practice and those who don't do anything. One may practice some spiritual disciplines, though it may not be enough to take you to your highest goal, still it develops in you a kind of sensitivity, a spiritual sensitivity, which helps you to turn the flashlight into your own heart, revealing the dark corners. And so this man had practice enough meditation so he could understand that he made a mistake by getting angry with this lady. And he repented. Then he asked her, who is your teacher? And she said, my teacher is somewhere a few 10 miles away from here in a marketplace. And he may have thought that maybe that's, he may be a saint sitting on meditation with a long beard, disabled hair, sitting under a tree in a marketplace. That's what he perhaps thought. And he went there directly following her instructions, and he reached there and he found a muscular-looking meat seller cutting meat and a long line of customers standing in front of him. So he was shocked. And the moment he appeared in front of the meat seller, his name was Vyatha. So the whole dialogue is called Vyatha Gita. Vyatha is the name of the teacher. Gita means a philosophical spiritual song sung by, that's what it means, Gita. The Bhagavad Gita means the song sung by the Lord. So like that, Vyatha also gave this long instructions. So he gives him a long discussions. It's called Vyatha Gita. Now, how could a meat seller, apparently not a very desirable job for a saint, could be so exalted in spiritual life, which means no matter what we do and whatever may be a profession, it is possible to reach the highest level of spirituality if one is willing and ready to practice. Very often people, again I have to warn you, people mistake Vedanta to be a concept. It is not a concept. It is an experiential science. And Vedanta is a stage of human spiritual experience and not a concept or an idea. We often, this mistake is made in modern times especially. You teach Marxian philosophy, you teach Kantian philosophy, you are called a Marxian thought, or you are a Kantian philosopher, or you are called a utilitarian. If you teach J.S. Mill or Jeremy Bentham, you are called a utilitarian. This is how people look upon Vedanta, which is totally wrong. You don't become a Vedantin by reading Vedanta books. Of course, that's the best introduction, best kindergarten, of course. But Vedanta actually implies a level of spiritual experience. Now, this Upanishad has got another magnificent verse to explain about this. Asino duram vrajati shayano yadi sarvataha kastam adamadam devam madanyo jnadu markati. Now, this reality, it is within, it is without. It is with attributes, without attributes. So you find here a language of apparent contradiction. You know, even while being seated somewhere, it moves everywhere. It is lying somewhere, it goes everywhere. It is endured with joy and without joy, without any joy. Which means this Atman, this realization cannot be explained. So how do you make a statement that this is beyond explanation? The Upanishad resorts a very unique metaphor. So the Upanishad uses a combination of apparent contradictions, which is called negativa theologia, and the only philosopher in Western tradition, either theological tradition or philosophical tradition, what do you call it, is Meister Eckhart, who uses almost identical language to explain the super being in his Eckhartian theology. It's called negative theology, the theology of negation, where you use words which are apparently contradictory, but which actually implies it transcends both. When you say this is of the nature, it is with attributes, you are limiting what cannot be actually limited by a description or a definition. If you say it is attributeless or with attributes, both are equally limiting factors. So how do you imply that goes beyond both? It is with attributes and without attributes. It is beyond description, it is beyond definition, beyond explanation. It is only to be experienced, cannot be explained. So to drive home this idea, Vedanta uses this, it is called Nishedha Mukhavakyam in the language of Shankara's commentary, which you find in the Christian theology of Eckhart, who remained forgotten, buried for many centuries till Rudolf Otto brought him back to limelight in the 19th century. So this Atman is present everywhere. So it cannot move anywhere. It is present everywhere, so it cannot move anywhere. It is omnipresent, it is immanent, and it is transcendental. Now, what does it mean? So, Shankaracharya and other commentators give an explanation. When you look at Atman as something endowed with attributes, then you say it is asyanaha, it is seated somewhere, sayanaha, it is lying somewhere. When you look upon it as something without attributes, then you find it goes everywhere. Which means the absolute reality is present everywhere and it is immanent in everything. It is omnipresent everywhere. It is the inner resident of everything. It is also the highest transcendental reality. It is something that we can only experience. It is our nearest, but you cannot see it. Another word used to explain its uniqueness is yasakshat aparokshat brahma. So in Vedanta or in Sanskrit language, you know, there are two words, pratyaksha and paroksha. Pratyaksha literally means something which is within the jurisdiction of your eyes. Very pratyaksha means you can see it. Mean which is direct perception. You can see with your eyes, you can hear with your ears, you can smell or you can touch. No, anything which is subjected to direct perception is pratyaksha. This chair is pratyaksha for me. It's opposite. Let us say Siberia. It is not pratyaksha for me. It's only a word I've seen. It's not a place I've seen. So it is the opposite. It's called paroksha. It is not pratyaksha. It is remote. The chair is direct, but Siberia is remote. But Atman is not pratyaksha. I don't see Atman as I see this chair. But Atman is not remote, far away from me, because Atman is my own true nature. It is nearest. At the same time, it is not directly perceptible. So it's called yet sakshat aparokshat brahma. It is non-remote. That is, it is non-remote. That's the term that Vedanta uses, especially in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. So this Atman is something which is our true nature. When we realize this, we don't get a new knowledge. We are only realizing what we actually are. And it is possible in this life. It is possible for one to practice discipline through prayer, meditation, and so on. But for that, one should undertake the necessary trouble. So very often, as I mentioned, we look upon Vedanta as a concept. So we tell you, very often during interactions, when people ask, Buddha could realize, Shankaracharya could realize, then why not I? They ask the question. Yes, you look at Buddha, are you ready to do what Buddha did? See, people understand it in the world of science. Nobody asks the question, I am also as good as scientist as Einstein. Nobody says that. You have to work hard like Einstein in his area. Then you become an Einstein. In spiritual life also, at a different level, in a different realm, you have to work hard, following all the disciplines with intensity and vigor. Then we reach that experience. Not by believing in a concept. Believing in a concept is a very wonderful beginning. Just joining a very wonderful kindergarten. That's all. So this Vedanta is essentially a science of inner experience. And its uniqueness that's proclaimed in the Kathopanishad is that it is something that we can experience in this life itself. Is this life itself. It is called Jivan Mukta. Not somewhere outside. And it is possible to experience this without the intermediary of any external factor. But then, for becoming an Einstein, you have to go to university, you have to go to school, you have to study, and sit under a teacher and listen. The same applies here also. That is true. But then, once you realize that stage, then you transcend all these limitations. So now we will have interaction for half an hour. And please remember, we will continue. We will have the same session tomorrow also, 10 to 11:30 a.m. So the discussion will continue. Now we can have interaction. Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Swami, you said that the Brahman is illuminated in everything, but it's illuminated in a very small fraction in something like amoeba, whereas in Buddha it is to the maximum possible extent. Now, is Jivan Mukti something that is achievable even for organisms like amoeba?
No. Jivan Mukti is possible only through one's own spiritual practices, which amoeba is not likely to undertake. You know. Say, like Buddha renounced his kingdom, his comforts, and walked 1,200 miles, went to Bodh Gaya and sat under a tree with a strong determination. Ihasane, nasyudu me shariram, tugasti mamsam chila, vilayam chiyatuhu, aprapisiddhim, bhujan madurlabham, naivasanat kaya madasali chila. You find Lirida Vistara Buddha's life. Buddha, with such strong will, he sat under a tree, giving up everything and meditated. And then it took a long time for him to realize this. So the point is, one point remember is, you know, different organisms represent different levels of the unfoldment of the presence of Atman within. One may ask this question, in fact, I was asked this question on the similar subject. They asked, what about Genghis Khan or Hitler? The human beings, how did Atman manifest in them? So the answer is, if a brilliant light is projected through a red filament glass, it'd be red light. or a reflection depends upon the type of reflecting medium. Similarly, that's why tamakradu pasyadi vita shokaha dhadu prasadat mahimanam atmanaha. Through spiritual practice, meditation, through the practice of unselfishness, when we make our mind pure, when we get complete freedom from all mental impurities, then the reflecting medium becomes clean, then the Atman manifests, as it did in the case of Buddha and other great teachers. That's what it is.
Then one small follow-up is, if what you said is what happens, then the Atman of the amoeba also originated from the original Brahman, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So then how come it became impure and...
Yeah. That's true. The amoeba its reflecting medium is very primitive. The question is how it became impure. At the level of the srishti, the creation, amoeba is endowed with only a very primitive antakarana. Atman should manifest or reflect on mana or buddhi. Mana or buddhi, the same are used. So when our mind becomes pure, then reflection becomes clear, very effulgent. But in the case of amoeba, or in the case of evil human beings themselves, what happens? The reflecting medium is highly corrupted. So the reflection will be primitive. But it may take perhaps, if you think of the vastness of the universe, cosmos, and the time concept, the infinity of time, then it may be that it may take trillions of years for those lower mechanisms to evolve. That's gradual unfoldment of purity of the reflecting medium. That's all.
Thanks. Thank you, Swami.
Yeah.
Once you're born as a human, you come back again as amoeba. Is there a possibility?
Because you when were an not, amoeba dies, it comes to come back as an amoeba.
No, a human. You were a human this birth, okay. But your duties are not duty.
Yeah.
And you go back again. And
I tell you. The dynamics of reincarnation in Vedanta, I shall explain. See, what it means, when our good actions, meritorious deeds, are more than the opposite, what you call punya karmas, they outweigh the papa karmas, then, you know, if we have done more meritorious deeds, then we will have an ascent in the evolution. Yeah. When, on the other hand, when the opposite of meritorious deeds outweigh the meritorious deeds, then there will be a descent in the evolution. That's what happens. So, let us say, people who take a natural interest in higher ideas. You know, not only higher ideas, even in art, music, and literature, higher specialized skills, extremely specialized, focused, concentrated skills wherever you find. It only shows by the logic, by the force of logic, that person must have already had some acquaintance with that skill somewhere. Now, you may explain it in terms of this life through ordinary psychological regression or hypnotism or psychoanalysis, but if you extend the realm beyond that, then it comes from another life. If you cannot explain in terms of experience in this life, it comes from another life. So otherwise, we won't feel, we won't have the aptitude to feel at home with those ideas. That's the idea.
And on that context, yeah. Where does the grace of God fit in?
Yeah, that's an important question. Grace of God, you can give. Grace of God has got a very important place. Suppose, no, Vedanta tells you that present life is, in a way, the, is a man, is a gradual unfoldment of your karmas in previous life. One part of the karmas called prarabdha karmas are responsible for your present embodiment, for all the experiences you undergo. Now, if a person, if any individual practices any kind of spiritual discipline, it may be reading scriptures, prayers, meditation, or helping others. That is also spiritual practice. Through that, what happens, you know, you get an ascent, an elevation in this spiritual evolution. So, when God's grace comes, you get an opportunity to evolve like this. If by the force of your prarabdha karmas coming from previous life, suppose you are destined to suffer a terrible tragedy, if you pray to God, by the grace of God, that tragedy will become a very, very simple, negligible event. If a person is destined to be bitten by a cobra, he will be bitten by a water snake or by an insect or ant. That's what Holy Mother Sri Sharada Devi mentions that. So, intense prayer, meditation, spiritual practice, and also good karmas, helping others, unselfishness, love, compassion, so on to other people. That will help us to avoid many of these unavoidable tragedies, or the intensity will be reduced. That's one thing. Second point is, to answer this question, prarabdha karma is compared to an arrow shot by an archer. The arrow has left the bow. The archer cannot withdraw it. But suppose a strong wind blows at that time. The arrow need not necessarily reach the destination, hit the goal, target. The arrow has to extinguish its velocity. It is wrong to say the arrow should hit the target. No. The arrow, its flight will be stopped when it loses its velocity. And that could happen when the strong wind blows. God's grace is like a strong wind that blows and deflects the arrow from hitting the target. So if a person is a spiritual seeker, is destined to suffer some difficulties or tragedies, it can be averted, or its intensity can be reduced to something very negligible through spiritual practice. That's the idea. So God's grace is important, but it is also important that we should work hard to become grace worthy. Otherwise, God's grace will not operate and will be of no use to us. So human efforts and God's grace have an equal place in spiritual life. Without our effort, we won't become grace worthy. We won't be able to make proper use of God's grace, even if it comes. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Swamiji, you mentioned Dr. Albert Einstein.
Yeah.
He was asked about his theories and relativity and so on and so forth. And he was given the compliment of such brightness in his intellect, but he said, it wasn't my intellect, it was my intuition. So within Vedantic experience, what intuition, or how has it manifested itself? Because we spoke of the senses. Now, is there a super sense or an independent sense, a spiritual sense, an intuitive sense?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
You know, in the Vedanta Yoga, both, there are five levels of human intellectual concentration. The fourth and fifth, Aikagriya Nirutha. Aikagriya means your ability to focus all your energies, physical, intellectual, nervous, all energy resources on one point. It's called Aikagriya. Now, great scientists, when they reach that level of concentration, very often they just go beyond the rigid, narrow path of rational analysis. And that gap, we do not know where the gap begins. From another source, something is revealed to them. So this is what we call intuition in science, in art, in music, and many other cases. This could happen not only to great scientists like Einstein, great musicians like Beethoven, and also it could happen to a most unlikely person like Dostoevsky, who was a drunkard, actually. But even fully drunk in vodka, practically swimming in vodka, he wrote Brothers Karamazov, which is the greatest novel human civilization has known. So how did he do that? So it is nothing spiritual. There is nothing necessarily spiritual about it. They get a flash of some universal truths, but after some time they forget. It may not have any spiritually transformative effect on them. It may not have. But they're able to get a flash of some universal transcendental truths of human life. You find Dostoevsky's works, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, many of these great writers, some universal truths. You know how we explain. You read it, suddenly you hear, yeah, that's true, you feel. You don't get that feeling when you read modern thrillers. It is so unrealistic. It only titillates the senses in the most violent manner. But these great writers can make you merge in their thoughts, and you will share, you will communicate with them. How is this possible? Because they have this what we call intuition. So intuition can have a spiritual dimension. It can also have a positively non-spiritual dimension. It is the two sides of the same. The point is, great spiritual teachers like Vyasa, you know, Vyasa belongs to the same category in a different way. He was a great, marvelous writer, and he was totally depressed. You can imagine the most reputed philosopher saint of his time, whose own disciples were great saints, spiritually more evolved. Even his own son was spiritually more enlightened, Shuka. But this man was depressed. And sitting on the bank of a river, Narada, another saint, came and asked him, what's the matter with you? He said, well, I'm depressed. I have achieved all this. And then he said, you have written this wonderful Mahabharata. Mahabharata deals with dharma. Not dharma as understood in Buddhist tradition. Dharma is like a constitution, do's and don'ts. Good ideas, bad ideas, both. Great literary classic. That doesn't help a man in spiritual life. It informs you. It doesn't inspire you. So you write something really inspiring. It'll be a guiding light for our spiritual life. And then he wrote Bhagavata Purana, which is a story. It's a great, marvelous spiritual classic. When he wrote the last word, Satyam Param Dhimahi, that's the last word, which is the highest spiritual truth proclamation, he was completely freed from that depression, the grief. So when we do something which helps others, and if you are endowed with spiritual discipline, then these things will have a transformative effect on us. See, You can imagine St. Augustine, St. Francis of Assisi, all these are examples. Augustine was, his mother was very much worried, and he heard this, there's a transformation. He became a great saint. St. Francis of Assisi was a soldier. So their mind was attuned somewhere or other to something higher. So there was a transformative effect on them. But those who have not practiced any discipline, spiritual discipline, may have a flash of these universal truths, which you find in many classical writings, but this experience may not have a transformative effect on their life. That's the idea.
Namaste, Swamiji. So can you elaborate on how to connect the intellect with the Atman?
Yeah.
How to go about that? And along the way, you talked about Vyasa and Vyadha.
Vyadha,
both of them. But they had their own purpose in life. One wrote the Bhagavad Gita and another was a butcher. So can you elaborate on how to connect the intellect to the Atman and also what is our purpose in life?
One way is, to begin with, our intellect is normally busy with so many diverse ideas, diverse sources of information, knowledge. And so there is a lot of diversity of ideas and emotions and samskaras that intellect brings to your system. So that's a big problem. So what we can do to begin with, we must focus more and more on connecting the intellect with ideas which are spiritually enriching in nature. There are many ideas that intellect may bring in which could be poisonous to our mind, which may not be helpful, not healthy. And there are many ideas which could be spiritually enriching. So to begin with, we cannot shut down one part of the intellect. Tomorrow onwards, I shall read only. It's not always possible because the mind, the accumulated tendencies and impressions will drag your intellect in another direction. We often listen to the dictates of the mind, not of intellect. With the intellect, we take a decision, but with mind only we act. Mind should give green signal to the senses. Then only the senses will act. Intellect is somewhat remote. But the point is, intellect can directly control the mind at a higher level, not a low, begin with. So at the beginning, what we can do, what a person should do is, along with other engagements, intellect should be given some engagements which may bring spiritual food to the mental system. Every idea is like food, good or bad, poisonous food or healthy food. So spiritual ideas, even philosophical ideas, give your intellect a grand idea, some creative work, which may not be always spiritually connected to spirituality, but then which may not be harmful to spiritual life. That's one way. In a way, intellect also should be given some engagement, some creative diversion. That's the beginning of connecting intellect to Atman. Otherwise, it is not possible. So bring more and more spiritual food into the system, and proportionately you find mind begins to cooperate. Mind refuses to cooperate. That's why we feel conflict. Conflicts do not arise at the intellectual level. Conflicts arise at the mental level. What we call intellectual conflicts are really conflicts of the mind. And when we talk about mental conflicts, we are talking about two types of impressions, vasanas and samskaras that we have accumulated in the system, good and bad. They clash, which we call conflict. So in this conflict, good samskaras, good vasanas should succeed, should win the war. So how do you make it? You make it richer, stronger, and healthier by bringing more food. So, reading good books, discussing good ideas, and as far as possible, associating with people whose company, whose association will bring good spiritual food to your intellect. All these are various means to that.
What's our purpose?
Yeah. Oh, well, what's the purpose of spirituality?
No, purpose in this life, if you were to write.
Well, yeah, I mentioned this morning, you know, priority.
Priorities, yeah.
Yeah, see, everyone has his own or her own priority. Very often, this priority is dictated by the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody asks the question, why should there be a God? Why should I worry about God? You should not ask such a person to go to temple and pray. It'd be a crime to ask him to do that. But if he's understood, you won't ask this pray, ask his question. So what you should do? Well, you should lead your normal life. You work. And if maybe eventually in course of time, you will feel a need for looking for something else other than what is normally available. At that moment only, one can think of these higher things. So I can give you, see, Bertrand Russell, who is an agnostic. He has not included many of the Christian theologians who are spiritual teachers among philosophers. We'll dismiss them all as theologians, which is some lower category. Actually, they were greater philosophers than Hume, Locke, and all these people. Leibniz, Nietzsche, and all that. But still, so very often, people who are intellectually endowed do not consider anything spiritual as worthy of even referring to or even speculation. Nothing wrong in it. Everyone, you don't scold a kindergarten boy, why don't you go to Harvard? He will go to Harvard for 30 years. Not now, let him study there. You don't make fun of him for not going to Oxford. He may go maybe after 30 years. That's all. Okay. Yeah.
Certain behaviors we more or less agree strike us as, or we perceive as, evil. Is this just a relative thing according to Vedanta? Is it Maya?
Yeah, yeah.
Or does it have any true reality?
Yeah. You know, Vedanta, he approaches the problem of evil from a different perspective. You see, the Western concept of evil is influenced by the Judeo-Christian theology of a rival to God is almost as strong and as persistent who is sitting there somewhere to drag the souls in his direction. So he's almost a rival to God, almost a parallel entity. So it's a dualistic system. But I'm talking about Advaita Vedanta, non-dualistic philosophy. In non-dualistic philosophy, the same problem is approached from a different perspective, a theory of error. Not theory of evil, but theory of error. Which means you commit a sin, or what normally people call a sin, not because of evil, but because of your ignorance. Ignorance also should not be interpreted in its superficial dictionary meaning. Ignorance here means your lack of or absence of the knowledge of Atman. That absence of knowledge, that ignorance, can have various varying degrees. There are different levels of this, the presence of this ignorance. So one commits a wrong thing because of ignorance, error. So theory is called theory of error. That's because Vedanta doesn't posit a parallel entity to Atman, God. It is a non-dual. It is called Ekam Adhutiyam, one without a second. So in popular Hindu mythology and in all non-Advaitic systems, there is, of course, this sort of parallel entity, as in monotheistic Brahmic traditions. But in Advaita Vedanta of Shankaracharya, one makes a mistake, one becomes evil due to ignorance. So there are demoniacal characters, evil characters, all over Hindu mythologies, terrible fellows. They were all villains, you know. So they were evil, as we understand them, but they were evil because they had not knowledge, realization of the highest truth. This absence of realization have various levels of thickness about it. Ignorance have different degrees, different levels of thickness, intensity. That's what it is.
Better description would be ripeness and unripeness.
That's right, right. Yeah, that could also be, even unripeness can have various levels of unripeness. Like that. That's it. So I can give an example. This is very interesting. See, a student or a spiritual seeker has done a lot of spiritual disciplines, but still has to advance something. His level of unripeness or, let us say, ignorance is different from the level of ignorance of a Genghis Khan or a Taimu or a Hitler. So you can see the difference. So there's a qualitative difference. So the final answer to the question is, if everyone understands his true nature, that is that divine reality within, and everyone is also part of it, then it's fine. That's why the highest devotee of God is described in Bhagavata Purana as one who sees the whole humanity, the whole creation in God, and God in the whole creation. Sarva bhudeshu yapasyet bhagavad bhava matmanaha bhudani bhagavadi atmani esha bhagavata uttamaha. Mean the highest devotee is one who sees God in everyone and who sees everyone in God. It's a kind of spiritual egalitarianism. And that takes you very close to Advaitic realization. The unity and oneness, one without a second. When you feel the presence of God in everyone, you cannot do any harm to anyone. Because you see God in everyone, and you see everyone in God. That's the idea. Yeah.
Life forms. I remember Lord Krishna mentioning that all souls finally reach me. The final destination is they reach me. And when they reach me, I would decide by their deeds whether they're going to be reincarnated or they finally merge with me forever. And deeds of amoeba could be what it is capable of doing. It may not be compared to what human can or other life forms can do. So it could be just life and death for it, and it did it better. And that's probably the way it finally reaches him and never come back.
No, I tell you, of course, I shall answer the first question and then come to the next. Then you'll repeat next one.
I'm not asking you a question. I'm just referring some of the text that I remember as a comment.
Okay, the first thing, there is one statement in Sri Ramakrishna, somewhat little different, but that's what he says is, those who have prayed at least once sincerely to God will come to me. I will decide or not what he says. Another point he says, when he sees them, he can understand where, at what level of spiritual evolution they have reached. Okay, now the point is, what Sri Ramakrishna meant was this. Any spiritual seeker, anyone, no matter what religion, what nation, what culture, even those who have not believed in God even, those in the past, anywhere they have practiced great spiritual disciplines or prayed to God, they will find in Sri Ramakrishna something which is sustaining, agreeable. That's why you find among Sri Ramakrishna's visitors, Dakshineswar, they were non-believers, agnostics, rationalists, and people who didn't care for spirituality, but they found in Sri Ramakrishna something that was sublime, that was spiritually sublime. So there, he didn't perhaps mean the particular individual, anyone who has prayed any time in the, even the previous life cycles, if they come there, they will find in him something. That is true. When you, that's if a spiritual seeker has done some spiritual disciplines in the past, if you read the lives of great spiritual teachers, you find a natural affinity. You need not necessarily belong to the particular cultural tradition to which that teacher belongs. But Sri Ramakrishna's own disciples, like Kesava Chandra Sen, Yam, they were all great admirers of Jesus, great scholars in biblical literature. Many of them had profound scholarship in biblical literature. They are not baptized Christians. How did they get attracted to Jesus? Because they found in Jesus' life some spiritual things. So like that, there were Christians, non-believers, and many even agnostics who came to Sri Ramakrishna. They found in him a very agreeable, likable person. I mean, they found this a wonderful person. So that's natural for every sincere spiritual seeker. That's what Sri Ramakrishna meant by this day. So thank you. We will continue this session tomorrow. So tomorrow again we will have the discussion from 10 to 11:30 and then refreshments from 11:30 to 12 and from 12 to 12:30 meditation. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.